irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kourula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hollywood, this is your host with the most, Nikki Kourula. I am here with a very amazing guest. Eddie Pence is at a show tonight. We're going to jump right into the interview. I have one of the best in the industry when it comes to concert photography. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Neil Preston. Say hello, Neil.
Hello, everybody.
All right. Our studio audience loves you already.
Love that audience.
So, Neil, you have taken some of the most iconic photos of bands like Led Zeppelin, Queen, Bruce Springsteen, artists like Bob Marley, Michael Jackson. I mean, the list goes on and on and on.
Ooh.
The Who, yep. Paul Simon. I mean, Pearl Jam. I mean, so many iconic bands in almost every generation.
Pretty much anyone other than the Beatles. I'm a bit too young to have done it. Although I've worked with three of them individually, and Elvis. Other than that, you know, as Tom Petty said, there's only one guy I'm going to call Elvis, and it wasn't Costello. So. But other than Elvis and the Beatles, I've pretty much run the table.
All right, before we get into all your concert photography, let's talk a little bit. Let's get a little bit into your backstory. How did you get into photography? What was your moment of zen that made you want to take pictures in the first place?
Well, there were basically two kind of nuclear bombs, cataclysmic events in my life. One was February 9th, 1964.
And is that the Beatles,
yeah,
right?
That's the first night the Beatles were on the Ed Sullivan Show. And that changed, my life changed in 60 minutes. I'm not kidding, literally. At 7:59, I was a kid who only cared about if Mickey Mantle hit any home runs and, you know, what did the Yankees do and, you know, how late can I go out and play stickball before it gets dark. at 9:01, all I cared about was rock music, the Beatles, learning to play guitar, and all my friends, the same thing happened to all of us. We all had the same epiphany at the same time. I mean, my life changed in an hour.
And did you know the Beatles before they were on that show?
No.
Wow.
I was, 12 years old. My mom and dad and I, you know, our family would watch the Ed Sullivan Show as a rule. I mean, frankly, there was nothing else on.
Right.
At 8 o'clock on a Sunday night. But I had not read anything about them, which is, in retrospect, unusual because I'm an avid newspaper reader and voracious newspaper reader. And turned it on, the Beatles were on, and that's all she wrote. So that was the music end of it. And a short time after that, maybe 6 months or so, my sister, who was older than I, got married, and her husband's, so my brother-in-law,
right,
gave me my first camera.
That is,
I mean,
awesome.
I'd been given a little brownie camera before, but gave me my
like
first
a real camera.
Yeah, it was an Ansco Speedx 4.5, and it was, you'd press a button and the lens and the bellows would come out, and it spoke to me. I didn't know how to use it, and I kept trying to take a picture, and nothing would happen. And then I realized there was a little silver tab that you could pull over, and it would cock the shutter, and it would lock in. You'd take a picture and go, whoosh, you know, cock the shutter, take the picture, cock the shutter, take the picture. And the only analogy I can make is that it's like when you're they didn't have driver's ed class in my high school, but when you're in high school and you're 16, you take driver's ed class. You don't necessarily know how to drive, but you kind of get the relationship between right. the brake and the transmission and the pedals, you know. And that's what having a camera in my hand was like. And so I had all of a sudden two huge hobbies, photography and rock music. And yeah, I was in a garage band for a while like everyone else, but my level of guitar playing talent kind of topped off at, you know, 15 years old or so.
Well, the camera became your instrument.
Well, yeah, it wasn't going to go anywhere. But I was always I always felt normal with a camera in my hand or next to me or something like that. And what happened was I started taking my camera to rock shows when I got old enough to go to rock shows.
Do you remember the first rock band that you shot?
Well, I found a roll of negs about 3 years ago in my files that said, I grew up in Forest Hills, New York, in Queens, and on the negative sleeve it said, Bee Gees, Forest Hills Tennis Stadium, like 1968. So that must have been like August. I remember taking a girl but bringing my camera. And through a weird series of events and flukes, I ended up meeting a guy who, me and my two buddies, we were all big photography buffs. We thought that there this office near our houses was a ticket office for the local concert series.
Right.
We figured, well, we've taken some pictures at one of these shows. Maybe if we give them some prints, we can score some free tickets. So we went into this office. Turns out it was the promoter's office. And I met two very important guys named Gary Kerfurst and Shelley Finkel. Gary went on to manage the Vagrants and Leslie West from Mountain and Mountain. And I believe he may have managed the Talking Heads at one point and a couple of other big bands. And Shelley Finkel, his partner at the time, went on to be a big boxing promoter, boxing manager and promoter, and managed Mike Tyson for years.
Wow.
And these are the guys that were running this little company called Concept Concerts, and they started letting me and my buddies into their shows to take pictures. And I was the one of the three buddies that kept on with it, and I just started meeting people. It was all very organic. There was no,
and what a vibrant time,
well,
too.
Well, yeah, there was no such thing as to use an expression I hate, rock photography or music photography. It was just photography.
Right.
And you didn't have to hide your camera with a 300-millimeter lens in your boot and your pants.
Or only shoot three songs, right?
That's well, don't usually get me started on that. We'll need a whole other show for that. But, you know, it was a burgeoning end of the industry, and it was happening at the same time in different cities. You know, me and some other people in New York, Jim Marshall, some
Jim
other
Marshall,
people
yeah.
in San Francisco, friends of mine in Chicago. I mean, there were certain people who gravitated towards it all, you know, all around the same time. I think my first assignment, I must have been 16 or 16 and a half.
That's
certainly
crazy.
Not more than 17. And I graduated high school. I was in the class of 1970, graduating class of Forest Hills High, and we were the first and only graduating class to not have a senior prom or class rings. The prom was all canceled due to student apathy. In other words, we're all too loaded and high to buy tickets. It's true.
That's so funny.
But by the time I was a senior, I was already working and
right.
a published photographer. I was going to go to college. I had picked out three colleges, applied to all three, and I was accepted to all three. And I had made the decision to go to Philadelphia College of Art because I had a bunch of friends in Philly, and they had a very good photography program. And one day, I don't know what came over me, but I walked into my mom and dad's bedroom, and I said, okay, so I'm going to run down the street and pick up the paper and get the groceries. I'm not going to go to college. I'll get the dry cleaning. Yeah, I just slipped it in. Tried to slip a knuckleball by them. And they were cool with it.
That's amazing.
And a year later, I got on a plane in October 15th, 1971, and moved to L.A., which at the time was the epicenter of the entire music business.
Right. You had the early Eagles.
Well, not 1971. I mean, for me, you know, it was always the British bands.
Right.
You know, when you think about the Doors and the Airplane and the California, yeah. I mean, that was fantasy.
That was the whole era.
I mean, I thought, I was convinced that when I got to L.A., every girl that I'd see would look like the two girls on the cover of the Flying Burrito Brothers' Gilded Palace of Sin. And they did.
Right.
And then I found out that they were two hookers that Graham Parsons had hired for the photo shoot. But, you know, L.A. was fantasy land, and it was the epicenter of the record business in the U.S.
Well, you were one of the pioneers, along with Jim Marshall. I mean, the era that you
started a lot earlier than I did, and Jim shot a lot of jazz. May he rest in peace. He was a friend of mine. But, you know, people like Gruen, you know, Lynn Goldsmith, myself, Sam Emerson, Tony Lowe, Andy Kent, who was my business partner for years and shot some of the most amazing David Bowie stuff that exists. And a year later, I met my best friend, Cameron Crowe. We used to go on the road for Rolling Stone together and Cream. And it just happened. It's not even that it dropped in my lap. It was meant to be.
Right.
You know, the music and photography were both in my DNA.
And, you know, my heart's been bursting the whole time because Eric Clapton's my favorite. Mm-hmm. I love the Doors. All these pictures that you took, it's like you probably didn't even know that they were going to make history the way did.
Well,
because
you don't think about that, right? First of all, you're too busy working.
Right.
And if any, to this day, if photographer comes up to you after the show and says, dude, I took the most iconic photo of Phil and whomever.
Right.
I guarantee you they don't know what they're talking about because you need the benefit of the passage of time and hindsight before something is iconic. I mean, I took a very famous photo of Jimmy Page sitting in a chair swigging a bottle
whiskey.
Of Jack Daniels.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and literally how it happened, I was working for Led Zeppelin. We were backstage in Indianapolis, and I'm sitting at a table, and he's about as far away, Jimmy's as far away as you are from me, and I'm talking to someone on my right, and I had a Nikon with a 24 mil in my lap because I would always have a loaded camera in my hand or on my lap, and I was saying something to a friend of mine on the right, and out of the corner of my eye, I happen to see this arm with this bottle start to go up, and I literally just turn around, shot one frame, and forgot about it.
Right.
You know.
And then you see it later.
I didn't think about it. I probably didn't notice it for a couple of years, to be honest. You know, and it's just a photo in the midst of 1,000 a night that I'm taking.
Well, the crazy thing, too, it's, you know, I think the difference between a good photographer and a great photographer is instinct. The fact that you even had that instinct to just capture that moment and then forget about it and then come back to it, that's why it is iconic.
Yeah,
you know?
And a lot of it is instinct in terms of the art of what I do. Framing is instinct. Composition is instinct. Comes from instinct.
And then there's technique. That's refining all of that.
Well, yeah. And look, I thought if I was going to go to college, I could have gone to Rochester Institute of Technology. I was accepted there, where I would have learned about how film is made and this
right.
and that. You know, who gives a shit? I don't know if I can say
you
that.
You can say that, yeah.
Who gives a shit?
You get a pass of all people.
But,
come on.
You know, it's instinct, and I grew up in a showbiz family. My dad was a Broadway stage manager. During the golden era of the Broadway musical, he was the original stage manager for My Fair Lady, Camelot, The King and I, Fiddler on the Roof.
Wow.
On a clear day, you could see forever. I mean, stuff like this. So I've always been around theaters, backstage. And
extravagant personalities.
But more importantly, an appreciation of theatrical lighting and what can be done with light. And there, without light, there is no photography. Film, digital, whatever. Light gives you photography. It's the art of painting with light, essentially. So I always had an appreciation for theatrical lighting. And when I was old enough, you know, to get on the subway from Queens and go see my dad at the theater, you know, I'd go see him on Saturdays, and I'd have dinner with him at Horn and Hard Arts in Times Square between a matinee and an evening performance. And I, to this day, if when I go backstage anywhere, I get that same gooey, warm, fuzzy feeling that I would get when I would go to see my dad, because I equate being backstage with being with my dad.
That's amazing.
And that's, that alone is there are not a lot of people that can say that. So, you know, everything, all the stars aligned right in the right direction for me without me knowing it.
Well, the other thing too, it's what's, I just find this so fascinating. You know, when you were taking pictures, you wouldn't see them right away like photographers get today, and you wouldn't know the lighting.
I don't want to see them right away, even now. I mean, it's funny. Well, we have to cover this topic, I guess.
Let's jump into it. Film. Go for it.
I am not a fan of digital photography. I'm a fan of photography. The problems that I have are the... my friend Woody has an expression. He says digital photographs look so brittle, it's so over-sharp that they look like they could crack in two, like an icicle. And I know That's what true. He means. And the equipment is very persnickety.
Right.
And the workflow, in other words, editing on a computer monitor, is mind-numbing to me. The equipment can be very temperamental. I was in New Mexico on a shoot over the weekend, and we had what we thought was a corrupted memory card, which does happen.
Right.
And, I mean, I think my assistant, Jeff, shout out to Jeff Nicholson, thank you, but I thought he was going to have a coronary. He called me up at 2 in the morning. He said, I can't get these fucking raw files to open up. I got JPEGs, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, it's like a lab calling you and saying, and I've had one lab accident in my entire career, you know, where the lab
was that?
Ruined. Well, I'd done a photo shoot for Pat Benatar on a music video, and went and got the film the next day, you know, the transparencies, and, you know, you get the boxes of 36 transparencies, and they had like 8 or 10 rolls just rolled up with a rubber band. And I said, what's this? They said, well, they're just purple. They look like the camera had been open or something. And this is like 10 rolls of color film. And I knew exactly what had happened, because I know how to process E6 ektachrome film. I said, the camera wasn't open. That film was left in the first developer for hours.
Wow.
No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't. I said, yes, it was. And the next day I had to deliver the job to Chrysalis Records, and I had all the black and white, it was fine, and I had a quarter of the amount of color I should have. And I explained to the PR girl there, you know, there was a lab screw-up, and she couldn't have cared less, because it was the day after John Lennon had been murdered.
Wow.
It just so happens. But I ended up taking one of those strips of film, sending him off to Eastman Kodak, and I got a letter saying, Dear Mr. Preston, we've inspected your film, and it appears that the film had been left in the first developer for a minimum of 6 hours at 20 degrees hotter than it should have been.
And you're like, bingo.
And at the
I know
time,
my stuff.
At the time, and I had a charge account with that lab, and at the time I owed them, I think I'd run up a $6,000 tab, and $1,980. They had gone out of business shortly thereafter. But that's the only real lab problem accident that I can ever remember. I mean, there might have been something where a lab ran some film a third of a stop too hot or something like that. But this digital thing, and it, you know, the camera, everything's so expensive, and you pay for these bells and whistles that you don't use, that
right.
I don't use. I don't care who it is, professional, don't use. The instruction booklets are like a world book encyclopedia.
Right.
And, you know, if you... I use them on manual override. I don't want the bells and whistles.
Right.
I know how to shoot pictures. I focus where I want to focus. I don't need the auto this, auto that. I don't need a camera that reads me the LA Times, cooks me an omelet, and blows me in the
morning. Do you use like the law of thirds? Like, you know, I know that's like one of the...
No.
So you just
I use my eye.
That's the gift. That's the true gift.
I was born understanding composition.
Right.
I don't need the boy. That would that. And if anyone is just studying photography, throw that one out the window. That'll just slow your ass down.
Well, you know, that's what's so remarkable about your pictures. It's like, you know, in the age of digital, you know, editing and over-editing, you truly captured moments with light and image and timing, which is everything. Well, that's the language musicians understand.
And timing's a big part of it because, you know, I do love the music and... look, you've got lighting directors who are doing incredible things on stage. Why would you pop a flash on there and kill the light?
Right.
You know, just to get a sharp picture that you can transmit to some tabloid somewhere. You know, as far as when to snap click the shutter, that's somewhere in here.
Right.
And I don't know how I was born with it, but I do have a knack for that.
Well, I have to ask you this question because... it's been on my mind ever since I knew that you were going to be able to do this interview. One of my favorite pictures that you've taken is that one of Freddie Mercury singing, and he's bent over, you know, with his arched back, and you just see the sky, and you see all of Wembley Stadium. Yeah. It's a black and white picture. It is a very famous picture.
Yeah, it is.
When you took that picture, did you just know you had it, or was it just kind of like one of many that you just were,
It's funny that you mentioned that picture. After I looked at the proof sheet recently, I realized it was about the fourth frame I had shot that day. I mean, I shot stuff backstage earlier.
Right.
But I just started doing what I'm doing.
It's one of the greatest photography moments ever.
You know, look, I've shot more bad pictures than every photographer in the world put together, but I know a strong image when I see it. It's a strong one. You know, when I get in a shoot mode, I'm not thinking about the last photo. I might be thinking about the last lens that I put on the camera that locked up. And I'm very rough with my equipment. But in retrospect, if I would have thought that, I could have taken the rest of the day off.
Right.
I got that one. But, I'm working for Queen. I'm not there just to shoot Fred.
So did you see the proof first, or did you kind of develop?
No.
Wow.
Well, on the road, depending on where you're shooting and who you're shooting for, you know, what your deadlines are, I think I spent a couple of weeks with them in the UK, and then I don't remember if I had the stuff processed in the UK or back here, but on a Led Zeppelin tour, we would have different labs set up in different cities, and I would take every couple of days after every, you know, there wasn't necessarily a show on a Thursday and a show on a Friday and a show on a Saturday, but every day or so, I'd bag up all the film with instructions for the lab. We'd go in the night drop at whatever lab we were using. And the lab would have been told by me beforehand that we used to get 6 black and white proof sheets from every roll of black and white film, and plus all the color. So by I'm getting to bed at 7 a.m. if you know what I mean.
Right.
If I'm going to sleep at all, wink, wink, wink. And then 11 a.m. 12 noon. You know, knock on the door, and there's the lab guy or the bellboy bringing up the big box of film, and and I would have to collate. You know, there was a set of proofs for Jimmy, one for Robert, one for Jonesy, one for Bonzo, one for me, and one for Peter Grant,
and none for Amit Erdogan.
Amit was the label. You know, I'm not working for Amit. I'm working for the band. So. He'd see the stuff soon enough. I'm traveling with a slide projector, the old Kodak carousel ones with the round trays, and I'm having to do little slideshows. There's a very famous story that someone wrote up about me. The first night that I had to sit with Jimmy and look at color slides, and he used to have a movie projector he'd travel with, and he'd watch movies like Lucifer Rising and things like that. And I'm in his suite at the Plaza, and he's got the sheet up on the wall, and set up the projector and the off go the lights, and I've loaded up a couple of slide trays with what I felt were the best selects. And I'm racking through them, and he's sitting there and goes, no. I hit the next one. And belly. I mean, it's a little belly showing. Yeah, these photos are beautiful and sharp right. And pristine and gorgeous. No, crow's feet. No. And then I'd put in like one weird blurry one. He'd go, wait, go back to that one. Yes, I love that. Then I keep going, and the beautiful ones, no. Then the weirdo ones, yes, yes. And finally, I said, do you mind? Can we stop for a second? Turn on the light. I said, yeah. And I said, I'm not clear, or I need to be clear on what you like and what you don't like, because you're picking photos that you love, and that's fantastic. But I'm trying to wrap my head around what it is that you love about them.
Right.
Because, you know, I'm concerned with the fact that we need photos for magazines and covers and the thing, blah, blah, blah. You know, what are you really looking for? And he looked me dead in the eye and he said, I want power, mystery, romance, and the hammer of the gods.
That's awesome.
And I told that to a writer who
gave me
wrote
chills it. Just now.
Yeah, and that's what he told me. And
one of the great things about your pictures, too, is they tell so many stories. You have one iconic picture of one of many where Michael Jackson and Freddie Mercury are just, they're just nonchalantly having a conversation. It's also one of your famous pictures.
It's become famous, yeah.
And tell me where that was and what was the situation.
That was at the Forum in L.A., and I spent a lot of time with Queen in my career, and still do. I still do work for them. Brian May is actually the only rock star that ever came to my mom and dad's house.
Wow.
Which is another story. But
I just met him at Village Pizza.
He's the sweetest guy on the planet.
Great cat.
And for any of you guys out there that aren't aware of this, he is actually Dr. Brian
May.
That's
right.
He's got a doctorate in astrophysics.
In astrophysics, that's right.
And co-wrote a book with two other scientists about the origins of the universe. He also just he's got his own publishing imprint. He put out a book called Queen in 3D. He's one of the world experts on 3D stereoscopic photography.
I didn't know that.
For all you guys out there, think ViewMaster reels, you know, of the Grand Canyon. But he is an expert, and I'm proud to have the cover of the Queen in 3D book. And there's little glasses that you can get in the book. And at any rate, where was I going with
that? We were talking about Los Angeles, Michael Jackson, Freddie
Mercury. A lot of times with Queen, a lot of celebs would show up backstage in L.A., certainly in L.A. and New York. And I remember Andy Warhol showing up backstage in New York.
Wow.
And, you know, people like that. And Donna showed up, Donna Summer, Olivia Newton-John. You know, I mean, these were big stars back then. And I remember Michael and the brothers just kind of strolling in. Must have been after the gig, and I had known shot Michael a lot in the brothers.
Yeah, I was
going to
mention that too.
Hello, and I'm just a fly on the wall. I just shot some frames of Fred talking to Michael, and I'm the only one that has those pictures,
right?
That shot them together, and I found out about, I don't know, 5 years ago or so that night, I believe. They invited Fred to go up to Michael's studio and to record for a couple of nights, and he did. And actually, the original version of State of Shock that has Mick Jagger on the final version originally had Freddie Mercury.
Wow.
On. Yeah, little known fact.
That's crazy.
And there's a story that I think Brian told me this when we were down in South America. He said that Freddie was in the vocal booth, and Michael had his llama, like, in the studio right next to Freddie. And at one point, Freddie takes his headphones off and says, I can't sing with this fucking llama next to me, and stormed off, and that was it.
Wow. Yeah. So that's the reason he didn't make the cut.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess they didn't have it in the canyon or something, but I can't sing with this fucking... I could just hear Freddie saying that.
Well, the next segue I wanted to kind of reach is, you know, you're one of the few and rare photographers that also captured Michael when he was in the Jackson 5, and you kind of caught this entire, you know, evolution of him up into adulthood, up into Dangerous and beyond. Like,
yeah, I think the last time I fought, well, I used to shoot them a lot, the brothers, when they were kids. I think Michael might have been about 12 or 13. I used to shoot for a lot of teeny bopper magazines,
right,
like Rock and Soul,
Tiger Beat.
Yeah, exactly. And the black versions of those magazines. And we'd go out to the famous compound in Encino, and it was always that me and my partner Andy Kent would, you know, we'd, you know, I'd say, I'll take Michael, you take Jackie, I'll take Jermaine, you take T, you know, boom, 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 do some individuals, then we do some group shots. It was like a conveyor belt.
Right.
And Michael always, who was very, they were all very nice, and but Michael always struck me as a kid that had a lot more going on inside his head than anyone could imagine. And the analogy that I made once, there's this big book called The Michael Jackson Opus that came out after Michael died, and it's about yay thick. I mean, it weighs about 30 pounds, and they only did 1,500 of them. It's a big deal collector's item, and I wrote an essay for that. And I wrote about my feeling that Michael had the weight of the world on his shoulders even then. And like those movies where, you know, the king dies and the king's, you know, 8-year-old son is now king.
Right.
And they go to him and like, Your Majesty, now tell us what to do. And the kid's 8 fucking years old. You know, I don't know. And so there was always that kind of a feel around him.
That pressure.
Yeah, just that, you know, the weight, the pressure, the weight of the world. And I mean, supremely talented. You know, we now know that the dad was not the greatest dad in the world, but and I ran into Jermaine's son recently, and who and gave him some prints of, I guess I photographed him when the son, when Jermaine and Hazel had the son. He must have been 3 years old, and they're walking on the beach with him, and this kid went crazy. He said, "My mom, dad, me, oh my God, when did you shoot those? I don't remember." Well, why would you? You were 3 years old.
Years old.
But, you know, as time went on and, you know, Michael grew up, and then I remember shooting some pictures of him and Jane Fonda and Walter Yetnikoff when Off the Wall was a big record. And, you know, and then there was time with Fred and the Queen and the Victory Tour.
Right.
And then, you know, did a lot of stuff on the Bad Tour in Japan.
Yeah, so that's a very iconic photo, too. Of
apparently that's peak Michael Jackson in terms of, you know, his performance life. We had a picture set up that we needed to do as a People magazine cover, and the night before I had scouted the location, I wanted to do this shot of him with the lights of the Ginza in the background. And we had arranged that Michael would get in a van and would meet us at this corner at this hour, and we didn't tell anybody else. And it was just me and the magazine writer, and we went out there, and I put up my little light, and, you know, people are ignoring us. And right at the appointed minute, the van drives up, and at the same minute, maybe 10 seconds, 5 seconds later, hordes of teenagers come from the other direction out of the subway station. I don't know how they found out. You know, I mean, they were following the van. And I tried to get the shot I wanted, but I couldn't. I was shooting the wrong direction.
Right.
I mean, Michael got up on my little thing that I built for him, and he lasted about a half a roll of film. And it was pandemonium, so we had to leave. But I think there's a black and white picture in the book. And it's a test frame, but you see Michael, you see the security guys looking at me trying to keep the kids back. But what you don't see is the fact that I wanted to be shooting the opposite direction anyway. So he was so famous. But I think the last time I photographed him was when he did that live interview, worldwide satellite broadcast with Oprah,
right,
during the first lawsuit.
Yeah.
And he remembered me. He was very sweet, and he came over and said, "Hey, how are you? Good to see you." I think he probably didn't remember my name, but, you know, he shook my hand, gave me a hug, a couple of seconds of small talk, and he went away, and I smelled this sickeningly sweet perfume, and I realized he's doused his hand in a massive amount of perfume, and my hand stunk for days, you know.
That's amazing.
I, you know, and the only photographers there were me and his guy. So.
Well, one question I have to ask you, you said there was, you know, when we were off the air for a minute, you said there was one show where you had this moment of zen and you said, oh my God, I can't believe I'm here shooting this. What was that show? What was that concert?
As I've said, you know, when I'm working, I'm in work mode. I don't sit around thinking, oh my God, I'm on stage with Led Zeppelin, I'm so cool, or they're so cool, or blah blah blah. I'm working. I'm on the crew. I mean, I don't think that any more than the sound mixer stops and goes, wow, you know, where am I? And there was one show, and it was a Bruce Springsteen show, and it was on the Born in the USA tour, and I think it was in Slane, either Leeds or Slane Castle in Ireland. And you know, Bruce would do 2 hours and take a break and do like an hour and a half or so. And during the break, I smoked a big bowl of hash. And for whatever reason, I mean, I had my cameras with me, but I just sat kind of in back of Max or off to the side and just watched. And just all those feelings of, how did I get here? I'm so lucky. I'm beyond fortunate. Not I'm so cool, but how did
what
I
a
get
gift.
Here?
Yeah.
That's the only time I can remember thinking that.
Was that the show that you have? Because you have a very iconic Bruce Springsteen.
That photo is at Wembley as well. Wembley was one of my good luck venues. Wembley, the Forum, the Garden, the Omni in Atlanta, which is no longer up. There were a couple more, but for some reason, those were my places. The Palladium. You know, good luck venues, whatever.
Let's talk a little bit about the British invasion with Led Zeppelin and Cream. Tell me what that experience was like, because you also documented. You were one of the few photographers that actually got, you know, to document so much of Led Zeppelin. Like, not a lot of people were led into that circle.
Right. Very few. I mean, I was the only guy or only person ever hired to be a tour photographer for Led Zeppelin. Actually, the first time I had photographed them was in 1970.
Wow.
I just graduated high school probably a month before, and somehow they Jimmy and Robert held a press conference. They came into a room. There were a bunch of reporters, and you can see it on YouTube. The band had been voted the most popular band in Britain by Melody Maker readers, supplanting the Beatles, who had won it the last 8 years in a row. Now all of a sudden, Led Zeppelin's the biggest band in the world, according to Melody Maker. And Jimi Hendrix had died the night before, and Jimmy and Robert come in, and all the questions that, especially Robert's, being peppered with, are about Jimi Hendrix and drugs. knowing Jimmy and Robert as they do, they probably couldn't care less about doing the press conference. But I photographed them at the press conference. And then they did two shows at the Garden. I believe they might have done afternoon show. They did a show that night after the press conference, I guess the night after. So that was the first time I'd photographed them. I photographed them in 72 for Atlantic Records, and then I started getting in with them. And by the end of 73, I was working for them, and all of 75, all of 77. Then that
such
worked.
Iconic records and tours they were doing.
Yeah,
you know,
look, it's Led Zeppelin. We're going first class. We have the Starship. We're staying in great hotels. People always have asked me, definitely during interviews, you know, I bet you had a lot of fun, wink, wink, with Led Zeppelin, you know. Bet you fucked a lot of girls and this and that. And, you know, I bet it was really crazy. And the last guy was this English tabloid guy who interviewed me. And I said, well, if you're using the word crazy as a euphemism for sex and drugs, I'll tell you I got a lot crazier with REO Speedwagon than I did with Led Zeppelin. And I'm not kidding. So, it's...
Is that kind of when you first brushed... You know, shoulders with Cameron Crowe? Is that around the time you
Cameron
guys met?
I met in probably early 72. And my girlfriend at the time was a PR girl for rock bands. And she said, you got to read this kid's stuff. And she gave me a copy of the San Diego Door. And I read some piece he had written. And then she said, he's 14 and a half.
Wow.
I said, you're kidding. And then I met Cameron, and we hit it. I mean, I'm 5 years older than he is, and we hit it off immediately. He was very bright and really funny, and we both had the same sense of humor. And I used to go down to San Diego when I had my license. I'd drive down there. We'd cover stuff at the sports arena in San Diego. Sometimes I'd fly, and this groupie that I knew would pick me up at the airport. We'd drive up to Cameron's place to pick him up because he was too young to drive. He didn't even have he was too young to even have a learner's permit. And actually, the real girl who got traded for the case of beer, like Penny Lane in Almost Famous, was actually that groupie that I knew.
Wow, well, that's crazy.
Who Cameron and I were on the road with the Allman Brothers, and
I was just about to get to that.
Yeah, and this really happened in 1973, and the Allmans, we were huge Allman Brothers fans.
I'm a huge Allman Brothers fan.
Greg was a god to us. And I mean, I had seen the Allmans with Dwayne before Dwayne passed away and before Barry passed away. But you know, this was probably their biggest tour, the Brothers and Sisters tour.
This is right after their live record, right? Live at the Fillmore, was that right?
Oh yeah, no, it was after. It was the first studio record after Dwayne passed away. And
I think that was Eat a Peach. Is that right?
Well, but Dwayne's on Eat a Peach, I believe.
But they recorded it, I think, in he had died in the middle of
right. But I don't think Dwayne's on Brothers and Sisters
at
all.
Right.
Barry maybe, but I don't think so. But the point is, you know, Dwayne Allman was the 6'2" god to us, and he was really high all the time, and he'd talk like this, you know, and we were on the road with the Allmans, and Cameron had done his first small interview with Greg, I think in Phoenix or somewhere, but he still needed the longer key interview, and he couldn't nail Greg. I mean, it was always, we'll do it tomorrow. Do it Wednesday after the gig. And Cameron and I are sharing the same room because Rolling Stone wasn't going to pay for two rooms for us, and there was a knock on the door, and it was the groupie, I'm not going to use her name, so-and-so. And, you know, what the hell are you doing here? And she was visibly upset. She said, can I come in? Of course, you know. And she said, well, I was partying. What are you doing here? You're supposed to be, you live in San Diego. We're in Phoenix. Well, I was partying with the Allmans roadies, and someone put me up for collateral in a poker game, and they lost, and I had to go with the crew to San Diego, to Phoenix.
That's crazy.
And she was not happy
about it.
She's the
real Penny Lane.
And I guess Cameron, who has a habit of being off in a corner, you least expect it, take the notes. He's got tiny little handwriting. He's my closest friend in the world. Yeah. I know his handwriting. Tiny. And 30 years later, it's a scene in Almost Famous. Everything in Almost Famous is real.
That is crazy.
And but the actual rock star in real life that the kid in the movie is following, the kid in the movie is trying to get Billy Crudup, who plays the guitar player of Stillwater, Russell Hammond. In real life, it was Greg Allman. And if I were to run into Billy Crudup right now or Jason Lee, they would not be actors. They would be the guys from Stillwater. That's how I related, because I did stills on the movie.
Right.
And
amazing
to me, it was like a rock tour.
Right.
It was just like a rock tour where there are a lot of film cameras around every day.
The crazy thing, like for me, you were witnessing some of the greatest bands and music and lineups of those bands. Like the very fact that you've seen Zeppelin live so many times, I'm so envious of. Allmans with
Dwayne.
I mean, that's crazy.
Well, I was at the closing of the Fillmore East. I mean, I can't remember I used to shoot at the Fillmore all the time, and like I said before, I was a guy who dug the, you know, English band, Humble Pie, you know, guys like that. And, God, I remember whenever the Dead were there, or the New Riders of the Purple Sage, I'd just smoke a bowl of hash and fall asleep in the lobby. I mean, I'm sorry, everyone, but I'm not a Dead End. Not even close. But, you know, Jeff Beck.
Right.
You know,
Cream. Let's talk about Cream.
Cream.
Eric Clapton's my, favorite.
Well, you'll love this story then. Cameron and I were in Macon, Georgia at one of the Allman's barbecues, and we found out that that Joe Walsh was playing this big outdoor gig in Miami. So I grabbed a girl I was seeing on the sly who was one of the editors of Cream Magazine. And we found this other girl who had a car. This is when you could juggle plane tickets and everything like that.
Right.
So we weren't going to be out any money. And we talked this girl into driving the three of us, plus her, it was four, to Miami so we could see Walsh, because we knew Walsh. And when we hit southern Florida, it was a torrential downpour. And, you know, we park and we're sloshing through the mud, but we could still hear music. And we're through the mud, you know. And we missed Walsh by the time we got there, and by the time we got word to whomever backstage. And we finally make it to the stage, and Eric's on stage.
Oh, my God.
And Eric is on stage with Pete Townsend,
oh my
Keith
God.
Moon. His band, it was 74. It was the Play Layla tour, 74. Patty, his wife,
yeah,
was
Patty
there.
Boyd.
And Eric's wearing a fishing hat and fishing overalls. And
he must have been loaded, because that was the time.
Oh, yeah. And I remember we got invited to the party after the show, after we were able to shower. And I remember Yvonne Elliman giving me the up and down to this day. God, I wish I would have acted on that one. I loved her. She was great. I mean, you know, it was so great. But Pete's my idol. And,
right.
And Pete on stage with Eric.
Eric Clapton.
Pete,
yeah,
on stage with you.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, and I'm not shy about this, but I'll pay $500 to hear Pete recite the Yellow Pages.
He's, you know, one of the greatest of all time.
And he's a probably a Mensa level genius, a Mensa level intellect. And I'm honored to say that he's a friend. And John Lennon holds another place very near my heart. But as I grew older, I really gravitated towards Pete and his music and his lyrics and everything about him. And I didn't realize that I was surrounded by this aggressive band that was really a guy band, you know, that appealed to guys.
Right.
And God, I love them.
They're awesome. They're awesome.
And my favorite album is Who by Numbers.
Oh, that's a good one.
My favorite Who record. And you know, the last time
I going to say Quadrophenia.
Oh well, you know, but Who by Numbers, you know, I it's just my heart. And the last time I saw Pete, it was, I don't know, 3 years ago or so. It was when they were playing at Caesars, and Cameron and I went to see them. And then backstage, Pete walked by with his usual grumpy look on his face. And if you're around the Who at all, you learn that you do not go into the dressing room unless you're invited.
Right.
You will be taking your life in your hands. You could have a Gibson or a drumstick or both, you know, thrown at you. And Pete's got his, you know, hands in his pockets, and it takes a look at me and does a triple take. It comes over and goes, well, hello, you know. Gives me a hug, sees Cameron next to me. And he shoos everyone else away and talks to us for like 15 minutes. Someone took a picture from the back, so you see Pete's back. You see me on the left and Cameron on the right. And I'm looking at Pete with the unadulterated joy on my face. And I had brought, I'd given him a stack of prints to look at. The year before, I'd given him to his roadie at one of the shows to put it in the road case, and Pete had written me a really nice note. Just stuff that from over the years I thought maybe he'd never seen or anything. And I asked him to sign a print, and he signed this print he was wearing white pants in the photo, and he signed it on his ass, and he said, "It's quite a fine ass," as he's signing it. And I said, "Not as fine as Prince's was," and he didn't even look at me, you know. But Pete Townsend and Bill Kerbishley, his manager, I love you both.
That's
Thank
awesome.
You.
Let's talk a little bit, like you were taking pictures of people like Chuck Berry in a time where there was all this racial bigotry, and just, you know, you were kind of defining a generation with some of these pictures.
Yeah, in the record business. Between musicians, there wasn't much.
None of that. But still, like, you were documenting a period where it's like a lot of people weren't embracing it as much. Like, what is so amazing is you were able to capture moments in time where you don't see any of that. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, Chuck, you talk about Chuck. Chuck was very famous for not having a band.
Right.
Chuck would travel from city to city, and in his contract,
he'd have a pickup band.
And I it's funny, I read in the LA Times when Chuck passed away, what, a year ago or so, Bruce tells a story about being part of the pickup band when Chuck came to Philly or something like that. And Bruce said, goes up to Chuck and goes, Mr. Barry, yeah. So what songs are we gonna play? And Chuck says to him, son, we're going to play some Chuck Berry songs. You know, but at the Palladium one night, the pickup band was Carl Radle, Jim Gordon, and Keith Richards.
Keith Richards.
So you got half of Derek and the Dominoes and Keith. And I'm on the side of the stage, and I'm, wow. I mean, I knew Keith was backstage, and they play a song, and then halfway through the second song, Chuck like stops the band, goes up to Keith, whispers something in Keith's ear. Keith unplugs and walks off stage like the little boy who lost his dog. He kicked Keith Richards off the stage, claimed he didn't know it was Keith, which I never believe. Said that he was playing too loud, which I do believe.
Right.
And I believe the rest of the show was just the three of them.
Wow.
And you know what? Somewhere I have a photo. It's a tight shot of this, like this, of Chuck talking into Keith's ear, but it's been misfiled or something for years. But I still have the pictures of Chuck having stopped the show, and Keith's in front of the amps looking like this, like, uh-oh.
I got to ask you, too, what was your favorite moment shooting Ray Charles? He's one of my biggest influences.
You know, I used to have a People magazine contract, which was essentially a guarantee for X amount of shoot days per year, but I would get all the music stories out of L.A. and a lot of the sports stories. I shoot a lot of stuff that's not music. But I went to Ray's studio, and Ray was an avid chess player, and he used to play Braille with a Braille chess set. Now, a Braille chess set is set up so that the tops of the pieces are very simplified, and the black and white squares are at different heights. And then, and you guys can't see. Well, I guess I'm on a stream, but I want to shoot him playing chess, so I would play him. So I played him a game of chess. Now, I'm no Bobby Fischer, but I'd like to think I could beat a blind man playing chess. He checkmated me in 7 moves.
Wow!
Swear to God,
really?
7 moves. He knew he was going to beat me. He was like,
you were the sucker.
Exactly. Now, granted, I wasn't really concentrating, but you know, when these guys play Braille chess set, they feel around. It takes like 5 minutes, and they remember where the pieces are, and it's fascinating. So that was my favorite moment was checkmate.
Yeah, and you've got this amazing book. I just want our listeners to know about this book. Neil Preston, Exhilarated and Exhausted. You can get it online.
You can get it online. It's published by Real Art Press. That's all one word, R-E-E-L Art, ARTPRESS.com out of London. Neil Preston, Exhilarated and Exhausted. It's 336 pages. So you can do your curls with it in the morning. But it's I'm very proud of the text. Because the way I wrote it, the stories are about my job and how I do my job. They're not gratuitous rock stories, but I talk about, and it's written very humorously and healthy amount of self-deprecation, but I talk about my job, what it's like to have a job like mine, the stress, the deadlines, the potholes in the road, the egos, the weird photo requests, the protocol for being on stage. Having Sly Stone smoke crack in my white Jaguar at 1 in the afternoon on the Santa Monica Freeway. All kinds of good stuff.
I got to ask you this, too. This is a two-part question. First, where can people find you if they want to, you know, ask you to take pictures for them, you know, for concert events, or if they want to interview you, or how can people get in touch with you?
You go to my website, which is PrestonPictures.com.
Spell it out because people are dumb.
PrestonPictures.com.
That's right.
PrestonPictures.com.
And this, I got to tell you before we wrap up, this has been one of the greatest interviews. I've been doing this for 5 or 6 years, and honestly, This is why I love doing this, because I've been waiting to meet you and to interview you. I got to ask you this one last question.
Fire away.
Of all the pictures you have taken, if you had to pick one picture that either to you was the most exhilarating, the most valuable to you, or the best picture you've taken, which would it be?
Well, there's two or three. There's the one of Led Zeppelin. I'm on stage, and you can see the dry ice. There's kind of a blue cast to it, and Jimmy's dragging on a cigarette, and it's during No Quarter, the song No Quarter, where he doesn't come in until after the first verse, and he happens to be looking right at me. I can remember shooting that picture, and what happened was I shot the picture, and he came over to say something to me. This is usually not a good thing when the lead guitarist in the band during a show wants to talk to me. and he says, is that the tour doctor in the front row? Apparently our Dr. Larry, our tour doctor, was in the front row with like eight blondes. Of course he was. He had the bag of Quaaludes with him. And I looked, I said, yeah, Jimmy, that's Dr. Larry. And he says, fuck me, he gets more birds than anyone in this band. He whips around and rips off a searing guitar solo. So that's a memorable one. And probably a couple of The Who. I have the cover of The Who Maximum 30 Years of R&B cover, and where Pete's flying off the top of the box.
Amazing.
That's the night that Roger Daltrey tried to kill me, but you'll have to have me back on.
That's right.
Story.
And I didn't even touch him on the Bob Marley. I assume you shot it at the Roxy.
No, that was at the Civic.
Wow.
That was at the Civic, and it was just a grab shot because I'm not into reggae or anything. I think he was opening for The Clash or someone like that.
Wow.
And I just shot a couple of rolls, and you know what? When everything aligns properly, you can nail a good... It's a strong image, I know.
Well, Neil, the universe thanks you for your gift of eye because...
Thank you.
Man, you have taken some of the best photos probably of all time and that will ever be taken, especially music.
Sweet.
So thank you for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood.
Anytime. We'll do it again?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, my God.
Okay, we just shut down it, everyone.
I could do a 10-hour interview with you. Are you kidding me? Absolutely.
Okay, well, then you're going to have to buy dinner.
Well, you got it. You got it. Well, on behalf of Eddie Pence and myself, Eddie Pence is not here, but he'll be back next week. We'll see you guys here next week.
Later.